Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for joining us this morning. Coming up on the show, the Arizona Game and Fish Commission passed a ban on animal killing contests, but do they go far enough? And we'll bring you a tiny desert concert from well-known Valley Band of the Technicolors.
Yesterday, the State Board of Education considered taking the first steps toward changing sex education policy for Arizona public schools. And KJZZ's Mariana Dale was there and joins us now in the studio. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Steve. And I definitely was not the only one there. There was more than 200 people that showed up to this meeting. It's the busiest Board of Ed meeting I've been to in a while.
Well, all right. So explain to us how sex education got on this agenda in the first place.
All right. So Superintendent Kathy Hoffman says she received a letter from Senator Martin Quezada. He is a Democrat from Phoenix. He sent this letter saying that he had met with stakeholders and that these were some changes that everyone agreed would give Arizona a better sex education policy. They included deleting a section that said sex ed materials, quote, shall not include the teaching of abnormal, deviant, or unusual sexual acts and practices, end quote, and then replacing that with that it must be medically and scientifically accurate. Another change would have given schools the option to offer some co-ed sex ed classes, and then there were some, like, small changes as well.
Okay, so let's take a second to break down the difference, please, between this policy and curriculum.
Yes. So at the very top now, we have Arizona's state law that says what you can and can't do in the classroom in a pretty broad sense. What was discussed Monday was board policy. Basically, those are more specific guidelines for public schools, but this is not curriculum. And by that, I mean that the books a child might read in a sex ed class, the movies they watch, the activities they do, that is all being determined at the district or charter school level.
So we take it that this room full of people watching the meeting were not shy about how they felt about these changes.
Oh, yes. They were very talkative, talkative for almost 4 hours, actually. And I thought we'd do a little lightning round of comments from the meeting. So here's Senator Sylvia Allen. She's a Republican from Snowflake. She did not support any changes to the policy.
Schools should never be in competition with what parents are trying to teach at home. I believe that our schools must be as much as possible neutral on controversial political, social, and moral issues.
Purple for Parents, an education group born out of opposition to the Red for Ed movement, also had a strong presence at the meeting. Veronica Corcoran was one of several people there wearing purple. She was also one of several people concerned that children are being sexualized too young nowadays.
When children grow up, they will automatically know how to act on their God-given rights for intimacy, sexuality, and reproduction.
There were a few supporters of the proposed changes in the audience and who spoke. There was Madeline Adelman. She's co-founder of the Glisten Phoenix chapter. That's an education group that advocates for LGBTQ students. She pointed specifically to a change that would allow students to learn sex education in a room with mixed genders.
There's lots of reasons why this could be a good option for some students, including students learning to be respectful in their communication with each other among people who have different bodies and different ideas.
Okay, so after hearing this variety of comments, what was the board's discussion like?
Well, it was relatively short in comparison. Superintendent Kathy Hoffman reiterated why she brought these changes forward for consideration in the first place.
The rise of STDs and STIs in Arizona is a deep concern for me. I'm also concerned about bullying in our schools and that there's been a long history of stigmatization of our students in the LGBTQ community.
But it was pretty clear that she did not have the support from the rest of the board. There was concern from board member Armando Ruiz that the board was basically overstepping its duties in considering these changes. He stressed that they should be taking direction from the legislature when it comes to sex ed.
Okay, and that's because that's what happened earlier this year.
Correct. So the board struck down a requirement that sex education classes promote honor and respect for monogamous heterosexual marriage. That was after legislators passed a bill removing restrictions around LGBTQ relationship discussion in school health classes. Governor Doug Ducey signed that bill into law, and all of that was in response to a lawsuit alleging Arizona law discriminated against LGBTQ students.
Okay, so our conclusion is that no additional changes to the state's sex education policy happened on Monday.
That is right. The board voted not to open rulemaking, which is really just a fancy way of saying there is no opportunity to make changes anytime soon to Arizona's State Board of Education sex education policy.
Okay. KJZZ's Madiana Dale, thanks for your reporting on this.
You're welcome.
Since February 2018, $56 million in potential federal child care funding has been sitting idle. Last session, lawmakers failed to allocate it and so failed to put the funds toward helping low-income families pay for child care. But now that money will be put to use, state lawmakers agreed to spend the funds to increase the subsidies paid to child care providers for the first time in nearly two decades and get people off a long wait list to access child care services. Mary Jo Pitzel has been covering this for the Arizona Republic, and she joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we had you on our show at the beginning of the year to talk about why this $56 million had not been allocated, and there really was no clear answer. So is there an answer as to why they decided to do this now?
Yes, the answer is that, well, now we have a plan. Now the state health department, which administers the child care subsidy, the State Department of Economic Security, now they've come up with a plan. They didn't have that before, at least to lawmakers' satisfaction. Mm-hmm. But now they had a plan, so they said, go ahead, spend the money.
Okay, so let's walk us through this. What will this money go toward?
It'll do a lot of things. It's going to raise the amount of subsidy that the state pays to child care providers, about a 33% increase, which means that there'll be less of a copay for parents, or it'll allow people to perhaps afford maybe a higher level of child care subsidy. Like, for example, until this took effect, the state was paying about $151 a week for an infant. And Lauren, you've been through that phase. You
yes.
probably know $151 won't get you really far
on
caring for a child.
Yeah.
So this will bump up those rates by about a third. It's also going to expand the number of kids who will have access to this. The state estimates about another 5,000 kids by the end of the year. And it got rid of the wait list, which has been around. It didn't get rid of it. They put it on hold. But the wait list has been around since the big recession of a decade ago. And that has led to waits of up to 8 months to get assistance for childcare, which doesn't do you much good if you need child care when you need it.
Yeah.
So they are now able to fulfill those demands when they come in.
Okay. And there was some bad news in here, though, for grandparents, some who called themselves bad A, something I can't say, grandmas. So what were they after?
They wanted to eliminate some of the red tape that happens for grandparents who are raising their grandchildren to get a subsidy that is used to help these lower-income kids. You have to fill out all these forms. They say, we don't get much help, much guidance from our DCS case managers. You know, why don't we just waive that and automatically say, send the money to mm-hmm. the child if grandma is raising the grandkid. Didn't happen. Maybe they'll be back next year.
Mary Jo, can I come back to the wait list question? So
yeah.
The wait list is on hold now because of this extra money. Does that necessarily mean there won't be a wait list again at some point in the near future? What does that mean?
There is a wait list.
Okay.
They will be able to reactivate it whenever demand outstrips the amount of money.
Okay,
that's
so based
available.
On this money, the demand has been met at least for this time period.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So there was also expanded foster care for some kids in this, the continuation of kids care, which we've covered, and a provision that will allow for faster adoptions. So it sounds like all in all, this was good news for the sort of social safety net for kids in this state.
Generally, yeah. Somewhat smaller moves. I mean, child care is a big one.
Yeah.
I should say that although the bad AAA grandparents, didn't get what they wanted. Lawmakers did put a lot more money into the kinship stipend, which is money that is paid to any family member who's taking care of a child who's been removed from their parents. It doesn't raise the amount of money that that person gets, but it allows him to serve probably that whole population of aunts, uncles, grandparents, big sisters who are raising children.
Okay, and in our last 30 seconds or so here, what is still on the table? What are advocates in this realm still looking for?
Well, they're looking to get rid of, they're looking for more assistance for grandparents and for kinship families that are raising kids. They get a pittance compared to what we pay to foster parents.
All right. That's Mary Jo Pitzel with the Arizona Republic. Mary Jo, thanks for coming in. The Arizona Game and Fish Commission voted last week to ban so-called animal killing contests. These are contests in which hunters are rewarded with money or other prizes for killing the most, the largest, or sometimes the smallest animals in a set amount of time. The issue has become increasingly controversial recently, as many states and jurisdictions have passed bans on this practice or resolutions against it. They say these contests are barbaric, allowing hunters to kill indiscriminately just for the fun of it. But some hunters worry this is opening the door to a broader assault on their hunting rights. Earlier this month on the show, we heard from the commissioner who proposed the rule, Kurt Davis, a longtime hunter himself, who told us the contests go against the guidelines set out by the North American model of wildlife conservation because of the money involved in this. But now that this rule has been passed, some are saying it does not go far enough. And for more on that, let's turn now to Joe Trudeau, Southwest advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. So, Joe, you called this decision a bittersweet victory for wildlife in the state. Why?
Well, certainly we're pleased that the Game and Fish Commission recognized the social and scientific problems with killing contests. And we're pleased that they voted to put an end to these contests. But the bittersweet part is because there are potential loopholes in it. And we would have liked to see those closed up. And ultimately, we didn't.
What are those? What are your concerns?
So there is basically two main aspects of the rule language as written that provide some flexibility that concerns us. And one of them is the idea that contests are defined by requiring registration. So that seems to be something that you can just bypass by not having registration. And then another one was we would have liked to have seen the animals that are covered by this new rule expanded to include all fur-bearing animals in addition to just non-game species.
Which animals are included in the ban?
So it doesn't say specifically which animals, and so that creates a little bit of flexibility in itself. So it would cover coyotes and fox and probably raccoons or skunks, but what about other animals like rabbits or squirrels, which are commonly hunted animals? Shifting contests from coyotes to rabbits would just become an inexcusable slaughter of rabbits in the landscape. And for people who are looking to just go out and shoot as many animals as they please, rabbits could become the next target.
So all considered, do you think, though, this puts Arizona sort of at the forefront of this movement that we're seeing to end these contests? We saw a similar ban in New Mexico and several cities and jurisdictions putting out resolutions against these, even though they can't sort of put teeth into those in that way. Do you think overall this is a good move?
Well, absolutely. It's a good move. It's a positive step forward. I think the Game Commission should be commended for recognizing that these contests were inhumane and not scientifically justified. And the grassroots activists that stepped up should be commended for becoming part of a solution. And at the end of the day, everyone should feel good about making a positive step forward in terms of wildlife management in Arizona.
So Commissioner Kurt Davis addressed these concerns at the meeting in which the commission ended up ultimately voting to approve the ban. Let's hear a little of what he said.
You can always look at any hunting regulation and come up with a conclusion that you think there's a loophole. But there isn't, because 99% of hunters follow the requirements that are put in front of them in the pursuit, an ethical pursuit of wildlife. We also have a professional department of over 600 folks that engage the public, engage hunters, anglers. And if there is a quote-unquote loophole in any of our requirements related to the pursuit of wildlife, they will let this commission know.
So do you think that adequately addresses your concerns here, or do you think more needs to be done?
I think that the commissioner is certainly correct in that the majority of hunters are law-abiding, ethical hunters who follow the rules, play by the rules. But there, it's that small, it's that 1 or 2% that we're concerned with. And those are the people who are most apt to participate in killing contests currently. So I'm a hunter. I would never think of participating in a killing contest. With this rule change, that doesn't really affect me because I never would have done that anyway. Mm-hmm. But those few people out there who are the gung-ho participant fans who go and do this stuff, they may not be deterred by the rule change, and they might utilize these loopholes.
We did talk to one of the organizations that puts on these killing contests in our original reporting on this, and she said, you know, what our real concern is here is that this is sort of your foothold. It's just the beginning of the slippery slope that this will lead to more regulations on banning hunting altogether. Do you think that that's the case, or do you think this is something that this is enough and more does not need to be done in terms of regulating hunting beyond this?
Speaking for myself and speaking for the Center for Biological Diversity, we are not utilizing this rule change as a foot in the door for ending hunting as an American tradition. There may be other people out there who see it that way, but I think that the most committed players in this process on the wildlife protection side are not radicals and not just trying to sneak in and destroy hunting. That would go against a lot of our own personal and organizational ethics to do something like that.
What else would you like to see happen in terms of these killing contests here in Arizona? Now they won't be allowed on public lands in this way. What do you think needs to happen in the rest of the country? What else would you like to see happen here in the state?
Well, as a first step, this rule passed by the Game and Fish Commission on Friday needs to go through the governor's regulatory review process. And in 1999, when the commission passed a similar rule, it died at the governor's regulatory review council. So it's really important that it makes it through this next round within the state government. And then in early 2020, the rule will be implemented, and it will be important for our game wardens, our conservation officers to be out there enforcing this rule, mm-hmm. educating the public. There's certainly going to be a lot of wildlife killing contest participants who don't know about the rule change. So there'll be a period of time where we anticipate Game and Fish Department on the ground to be in enforcement capacity. And we will definitely be checking in with them to make sure that things are unfolding as we expect. And if it looks like these loopholes are being taken advantage of, then we're going to have to figure out ways to tighten those up.
Mm-hmm. All right. Joe Trudeau is with the Center for Biological Diversity. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We just marked the 75th anniversary of President Franklin Roosevelt signing the GI Bill into law. One of the leaders in pushing the legislation forward and getting the opportunities to returning soldiers was former U.S. Senator from Arizona, Ernest McFarland. The bill made an enormous difference when it came to helping improve access to education, home loans, and business loans. To learn more, I spoke with Lindsay Cormack, assistant professor at Stevens Institute of Technology and the author of Congress and U.S. Veterans, From the GI Bill to the VA Crisis. I started by asking about how much of an effort went into making the GI Bill a reality.
So at the time, it took about a year and a half from the conception of the GI Bill to the passage of the GI Bill. And you're right that it was a group effort. Ernest McFarland played a big role. But there was also, as there is today, lobbyists who helped draft up the original ones from the American Legion. And then other people in the Senate and the House who helped usher the bill. It was something that was controversial at the time. We had a problem with how we served the World War I veterans, and everyone could see that probably wasn't going to work the second time around. But not everyone was set on thinking that the omnibus GI Bill that we ended up getting was a good idea from the get-go.
What were the arguments against it?
So one thing that concerned a few members was it was going to breed dependency on the government. At the time, there was this notion that, like, if the government was meant to pay for educational benefits, home loans, the ability for people to start their own businesses, they thought that maybe veterans would become too dependent on that sort of giving. That didn't come to be true, but it was something that some people who opposed the bill at the beginning, that was what they cited as their reason for doing so.
Many of us are very aware of the educational benefits from the GI Bill, but what are some of the other specific aspects of it?
So in the original GI Bill, there were two bills that were considered at first, and they were separated. One was having the educational benefits, and then others were talking about giving home loan benefits, as well as the ability to go to trade schools. And then in the final bill that we get, it's something that pieces together a bunch of different things. So people who benefited could use the money for tuition. They could use it to go learn a skilled trade. They could use it to go to flight school if they wanted to. They could also get a home loan based on credit that the government would issue to them in a beneficial way as veterans with interest rates capped at 4%. And so there's just a lot of different things. There's also some additional health care that is aside from the VA care that they were going to get via other mechanisms. But it was a really big bill that tried to deal with all sorts of things that veterans were going to face in a way that their civilian counterparts would not.
How open was it? Was it restricted to people of a certain background?
So that is a really interesting question. When the legislation was first being bandied about, FDR thought that it ought to be available only to means-tested veterans and actually to means-tested anyone. So anyone who didn't serve but was of the lifestyle that they weren't going to be able to afford these things on their own, he didn't understand why we didn't just give something like this sort of benefit to everyone. When it came to pass, one of the compromises, and I'd call it an ugly compromise, was made that said states would be able to administer the bill. And so it was the case that in the South, you had a lot of Black veterans who, by the law of the land, ought to be able to access these educational benefits. But in the way that Jim Crow worked, it was the case that state administrators wouldn't allow Black veterans to get the same sort of benefits as white veterans. And so that wasn't the intention if you look at the letter of the law. But in the negotiations that happened at the very end, it's very clear that the reason we allowed the states to administer this versus the federal government was to kind of let that sort of thing happen.
How much bang for the buck was there for this? Because it does seem as though this was beneficial in so many ways, not just to individuals, but overall in terms of how the country was able to make progress because more people had more opportunities.
It was incredibly successful. And the number that most people have kind of centered on is a 7-to-1, meaning for every $1 that the federal government spent investing in people, whether they're getting an education, that trade school, or a home, starting a business, we saw 7 additional dollars that were then tax revenue for everyone. And so this was something that was, at first, no one knew how successful it was going to be. They didn't know if veterans were going to even take it up in the first place. And it turned out to be something that probably saved us from another round of a depression that could have precipitated after World War II.
Does there need to be a perfect storm of sorts? It almost feels like World War II was a perfect storm in order for benefits to be more expanded or greater opportunity. And what comes to mind for me is the issue of education, for-profit schools, perhaps, quote-unquote, taking advantage of certain veterans who are not able to pay back and whatnot. Are we in a tough position now when it comes to even education is still so important for veterans, but it is hard to know who's sort of targeting them or who's making it work in the best possible way?
That is a really good point. And that's something that in an Arizona history way, Senator John McCain was really against these for-profit schools exploiting veterans for their GI Bill dollars. And that's something that Steve Cohen, who's a congressman out of Tennessee, just last week introduced some legislation to kind of ban for-profit schools benefiting from the GI Bill. Because sometimes it's really hard if you've come back from serving, or maybe you don't have a family who's used to higher education, it's hard to tell what is a good credentialed school versus one that's a for-profit school that might have really nice brochures, really compelling salespeople. And those schools, they set veterans up to fail, but they know that they're guaranteed GI dollars. And so that is like a really big spot that could be improved that I think a lot of legislators are aware of and working towards.
We have people on both sides of the aisle who certainly talk about support for veterans. That is in some ways, a feel-good thing to talk about that it's hard to disagree about. But do these members of Congress, for example, put their money where their mouths are? Is there truly a concerted effort to make sure that veterans and those who serve, that they're actually being cared for in a proper way?
So I think both of those things can be true. I think it is certainly possible to pay lip service to veterans without having done things for veterans. That being said, I have never met or seen any congressperson who's trying to actively act against veterans. Everyone likes to talk about our veterans in terms of their honor, their bravery, and there's not really a partisan slant to that. In terms of who's actually offering legislation, Democrats have a little bit of an edge. Even when Republicans controlled both houses towards the end of the Obama era, Democrats were introducing more legislation that benefited veterans, new legislation on women's veterans, suicide prevention, and things like that. And so both parties tend to valorize veterans, but it is the case that Democrats do a little bit more in legislating on behalf of veterans.
And that is Lindsay Cormack. She's assistant professor at Stevens Institute of Technology.
This is The Show on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein. Still to come, we'll have a tiny desert concert with Valley Band The Technicolors. And stay tuned at 10 o'clock for The Takeaway.
Not only is the Grand Canyon one of the most popular national parks in the U.S., it comfortably belongs on a list of the most popular destinations generally for tourists to visit. But a lot of work needs to be done to maintain its infrastructure. Last week, Coconino County Supervisor Liz Archuleta spoke to the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and reminded members the national parks need an estimated $12 billion in maintenance, and the Grand Canyon accounts for $313 million of that. With me to talk about where infrastructure improvements stand and the needed funding is Woody Smeck, acting superintendent at Grand Canyon National Park. So, Woody, where are we in the process of getting more federal funding for the Grand Canyon when it comes to infrastructure, and also some sort of reimbursement related to the government shutdown earlier this year?
There are a number of proposals right now before Congress to increase funding to address maintenance backlog in national parks. And the president put forward a budget request to Congress that included a public lands infrastructure fund that would divert revenues generated on public lands toward addressing infrastructure needs in national parks and on other public lands as well. So that's a promising solution to a growing challenge that's been with the Park Service for over a decade now, and that is the backlog of deferred maintenance that has built up.
Are there certain priorities at Grand Canyon you can tell us about that if, in fact, funding were available, there would be top three on the list?
Yeah, number one is the replacement and repair of the Grand Canyon the Trans Canyon pipeline, the water line that delivers water from its source on the north rim to outlets on the south rim. So a lot of people don't know this, but when you visit the south rim, the drinking water that you have available to you is really coming from the north rim, from a spring that's perched at 5,300 feet and then delivered by pipeline down to the bottom of the canyon, about a mile down, and then back up the other side and then distributed to points on the south rim. So there's an extensive network of pipes and pumps and holding tanks and treatment facilities that makes all that water delivery possible. And that infrastructure in particular is now over 50 years old, and a large portion of it is beyond its service life, and it needs to be replaced. So that's our highest priority right now, is to replace the pipeline and the different components to that system.
So is there an estimated cost for that kind of thing?
Yeah, right now we are starting to do the building up the engineering plans and design drawings, but the estimate right now is $104 million, and that would replace 13 miles of old aluminum pipe, and it would also replace or upgrade the pumping stations and some of the water treatment components that go with that. As you can imagine, a great deal of that cost is built into just the logistics of installing a pipeline in a mile deep canyon like this one.
When it comes to sort of the general love of our national parks, and obviously Grand Canyon is at or near the top of the list for a lot of people, are we in a situation where the need, whether it's something that's 50 years old or something newer, a greater need for the infrastructure repairs because more people are not only visiting the national parks, but maybe they're using them in a way that there were certain areas that weren't seen as much, but with the age of social media, more people are learning about things, so things are wearing down faster than they used to.
Yeah, that is true. The national parks have experienced quite a growth in visitation, especially following the centennial anniversary in 2016. And I think many national parks have seen visitation increase anywhere from 25 to 33% over the past 2 to 3 years. It's a good thing. We want people to get out and enjoy and use their national parks, and we welcome all visitors, but it does put wear and tear on facilities and infrastructure, and it's something that we need to take care of and maintain. Fortunately, with that increased visitation, we've also seen increase in revenue from entry gate fees that are collected and other fees. So that helps, but the wear and tear is outpacing that revenue source. And so a larger investment fund like the one that the president has proposed and like that that Congress is debating currently is really important.
With revenue from the visitor fees, is that what the canyon is in essence surviving on right now when it comes to infrastructure and other projects?
Yeah, that's correct. Right now, we're using about $17 million of fees that are collected at the gates annually, and we combine that with about $10 million in other fund sources that we have available, including appropriations from Congress. And that's our war chest to address our backlog of deferred maintenance, which right now currently stands at $314 million. Mm. So that $27 million, it helps. It's definitely making a difference. And last year, we were able to retire $16 million in deferred maintenance requirements. So it helps. But $314 million is a large number to tackle at these amounts. And so a larger investment is going to be required.
Are you able to go about your business on a daily basis and enjoy and appreciate where you get to work? But at the same time, are you worried about where things stand to some extent when it comes to some aspects of the infrastructure?
Yes, I do worry. My background as a landscape architect, I've spent my career designing and building facilities for visitors to enjoy the beauty of our national parks and in a way that protects the very thing that they come to see, all the scenery and diversity and wildlife and vegetation. And so as an architect, I look at the infrastructure and it does worry me that we're not putting the proper investment for its long-term care and sustainability.
Well, and knowing that it's dangerous to try to predict what Congress is going to do, are you able to be optimistic that some additional funding can be coming the Grand Canyon's way and other national parks at some point fairly soon?
I am optimistic, and I do think there's growing awareness of the backlog of maintenance requirements. And with that awareness, where there's more attention being given to it. And with all of that, I do see the future being very, very hopeful in the form of projects getting funding and important work getting done.
Woody Smack is acting superintendent at Grand Canyon National Park.
U.S. Navy veteran Robert Highschool died alone in his home in 2017. A concerned neighbor notified authorities, and with no will and no one to claim his body, it was turned over to a local funeral home, Able Funeral Services. The funeral home director failed to find Highschool's next of kin, so he got court approval to take over the estate, settle his affairs, and, of course, pay for his own funeral and burial. In the end, the funeral home paid itself more than $30,000 in costs. The average funeral and burial cost $7,360. The Arizona Republic's Ann Ryman wrote about this recently, and I asked her how it was allowed.
Basically, you're allowed to, in Arizona, come in as a creditor of an estate and become what's called an executor or a personal representative of an estate. And basically, your job is to settle the entire estate. So you pay the bills and taxes, you arrange to sell any property, and you basically close out the estate. Now, as part of that, as a creditor, also, you would then obviously pay yourself or your business.
Mm-hmm. And you looked into this practice more and found that it's pretty unusual for a funeral director to do this, but it is legal.
It is legal. You know, any creditor can come in, and as long as you don't have a personal representative on your estate and you don't have any immediate family that has stepped forward and you haven't designated anybody, you're allowed to do this.
Right, right. And they are required, though, to look for next of kin, right?
They are, yes.
How long does that process allow for? Like how much do they have to search?
There's no limit as to what's a minimum or a maximum amount of time, but they do have to make a, you know, a reasonable effort to find people.
Yeah.
And they do it through a variety of ways, through public records searches, internet databases, you know, whatever they can kind of think of in order to try to find the next of kin.
Yeah. So you're looking into some complaints about this particular funeral home, Able Funeral Services, and you track down some of the family members who ended up being next of kin for some of these families. What were their complaints?
Well, one of the complaints, the major one that surfaced, was that when they went over the bills for the estate, they felt that the charges for the funeral services were unreasonable and also excessive. In the country, the average price of a funeral and burial is about $7,360. In one of the cases, a fellow by the name of Robert Heiskel, who is a U.S. Navy veteran, they found that the personal representative for the estate had authorized payments of $30,194,
wow,
which they felt like all of that except for about $8,000 was excessive.
So you say this is legal, but isn't there an inherent sort of conflict of interest there when the funeral home director is the one taking over the money settling the estate, but also pays themselves?
The attorneys that I have talked to who have worked in, you know, the estate area for a long time, you know, say that there is a conflict of interest here because you're basically taking on a dual role. You know, you're not only the funeral director or the funeral home owner, but you're also the personal representative. So you are essentially submitting bills to the same estate that you're administering.
And tell us about some of these charges. It was just, there were pretty large charges, it sounds like, just for housing the body for sometimes a very long time.
Yes. In the case of Robert Heiskel, the Navy veteran, you know, he was kept at least 115 days. There was another case that I looked at that he was refrigerated for 250 days. And those fees were charged for each day that he was refrigerated.
So they're under investigation now because of these complaints. Was there any response from the funeral home director or from Able Funeral Services on this?
They said they are not able to comment on this. I did reach out to them multiple times, but because of the investigation that they're under, they are not able to comment on this currently. They did have to go through an initial review of the complaints before the funeral board last year. And
yeah,
so their response is basically, you know, they're taking on these cases and doing their very best to try to find the next of kin, which takes a really long time. And this method of becoming the personal representative is one way that they can deal with this process of trying to find next of kin and then eventually being able to bury the person.
Is there an argument on that side? I know you also spoke with someone on the funeral board. Do funeral home directors often have to deal with a sort of a body that no one claims or that is abandoned?
It does happen. And again, these are pretty sad cases. You know, the ones that I wrote about, it's people who die and they may not have any children or any parents that are living anymore. They may have lost contact over time with some of their close relatives. And so in some cases, they will die. And, you know, it can be a really long time before even a distant relative finds out that they've passed away.
So all of this reporting that you did in this area led you to also look into the importance of having a will. Tell us a little bit about why this is so important.
Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. Mainly, you know, if you die without a will, your estate will be divided up according to the laws of the estate that you live in. You know, with a will, you know, you're able to designate kind of who gets your property and who it goes to. And so it gives you, you know, a very important way to dispose kind of to your very last steps that you're taking of where your belongings are going. And again, it also highlights, I think in this case, what can happen if you don't have something like that, where you can actually have a creditor coming in, someone that you don't even know, that could be in charge of your estate in the end.
All right. That's Anne Ryman, investigative reporter with the Arizona Republic, joining us. Anne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Technicolors recently took a year off from touring after nearly 7 straight years on the road. Brennan Smiley, the guitarist and lead singer of the Phoenix-based band, said they were feeling burned out and needed downtime to figure out their identity. But now they're heading back on the road for their first headlining tour. Brennan joined us during the lunch rush at Crescent Ballroom for a Tiny Desert concert, and I started by asking him what it's like to go from a band that does a lot of openings for other bands and to get to a place where people are definitely there to see you. How does that affect the music?
We realized that we had just been opening for people for so long that we had lost a sense of identity in that, in the actual live setting, which is really hard to do for us because we have such strong opinions about like who we want to be and what we want to do. And it's just, you get used to opening the night and you're just opening for somebody else's party, which is fun and it can be great and it has been great. But like our identities were just getting like worn down. That was the first thing that we said when we took our break last year, is that when we tour again, it's going to be our own tour. We're going to start doing things on our own terms just because we needed to reclaim ourselves. So to answer your question, yeah, it does actually affect the way that we hold ourselves even in what we're doing. So right now we're rehearsing for this tour and the way that we're building out our sets, it has a completely different mindset attached to it just because it's our night. It's also a pressure that we haven't had to take on in a tour. We've done headlining shows, but as a tour, there's a responsibility there, I think, that we haven't taken on yet.
Let me come back to identity for a second then. So what does an identity, if it's consistent, what does that do for the band? Or can it be limiting also?
Yeah, it depends. I think our group of guys, we all love so many different kinds of music. And I think identity is vulnerability in your creation. And I think that's where I've learned that it comes from. So not being ashamed of masking the things that we like or the different places that we come from. Being from Arizona seems to be this place, as I've grown, feels like there are so many people that have come from so many different places, big transplant state. And so with that, you get a lot of different tastes in art, culture, whatever. And it feels like our band represents that. It's taken a little bit to realize it and also kind of embrace it, you know, because I think most creative people, when you start to try to do something, you copy your idols at the beginning. Then you start to chip away at the parts that aren't you. And really, you're just left with you failing to sound like your idols, and that's what becomes you.
But see, to me, that sounds like advancement as an artist, but also as a human being, which it takes some of us a long time to get there.
Yes, definitely. You know, we had to take a year off of touring last year just to focus on life things and let music, like, I don't know, breathe out of us naturally without a deadline of there being... it's this record and then the promo for the record's going to happen at this time and all those things, which again are very important, and you know, I see the purpose for them, but sometimes you have to step away and create like you did as a child where you don't know what a deadline is, you know, and so we had to get back to that for a little bit, but now we're feeling good. So
Brennan, you're going to play a song for us. What's it going to be?
This one is called Fall Off the Moon.
Keep me alone, keep my thoughts to the flame, lit by the afternoon. Wrap my attention in your dress, what a shame. I was afraid, so afraid just to let go. I was afraid, so afraid to fall off the moon. To fall off the moon with you. My mind full of sound. I need permission to keep my head in the clouds. With nothing to lose, I'm just here for the show. Cause I was afraid, so afraid, just to let go. I was afraid, so afraid, to fall off. Yeah, I just wanna see you tonight and know that you know that I was afraid, so afraid just to let go. I was afraid, so afraid just to let go.
So you've had some album work, obviously, but lately you've had the... Tell us about the Technitracks concept and the singles.
I mean, that essentially just came from us wanting to take a break from touring last year. And we had these songs that we had started demos for out here in Arizona right before our final chunk of touring, which was at the beginning of last year. In between two tours, we came and started recording them with our friend in Los Angeles, who's just a close friend of ours that we had wanted to work with. And we thought maybe it would be a short record or an EP or something like that. But we didn't have any concept around it. We weren't really compelled to put the music out in that kind of way. So what ended up happening was we did the last tour, took a month off from everything, all of us. I went to Florida. We came back and decided to chip away at these songs, and towards the end of the year we realized, like, oh, this has been really nice to just work on individual tracks separate from it having to fit into a record or this big idea. The song could be the big idea, each individual song, and that was how we had approached it. It was also a more creative endeavor for us. We had kind of no rules to where we could... Single is sort of ironic because singles are supposed to be poppy and like catchy, and these were some of our weirder songs that we've ever done. But that was what was fun about it, is we got to release them, and still are releasing them, as these kind of like more creative endeavors. Like, how much action can we pack into one song? But we are excited to get back to making records.
Brendan, good talking with you. Now you're going to take us out on a song. What's that going to be?
I'm going to do Turn Into Blue.
But I want to know that you know my heart ain't growing cold. So call me on your way back home. I'm listening this time, but I don't know where to draw the line. And I come down, 'cause we're always turning into something.
That is Brennan Smiley, guitarist and lead singer for the band The Technicolors, who joined us at Crescent Ballroom. You can see a video of his performance on our website, theshow.kjzz.org/tinydesertconcerts. And if you're in a band or know of one, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. The show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.